Coming up on Life is a Festival.
We have something around 17,000 crew and artists that work on the festival in some way, in some shape or another. I mean, there's a group at the top that kind of shape and set the ideas, and then the ideas just spawn out from that by the thousands of people that then make their small space down to a window and install in a piece of street set that tells its own story. I suppose you stand back and think, wow, I mean, how the hell did that kind of manifest into what it is? But it's a process of evolution, really. We didn't set out with this kind of clear vision of like, this is what we're going to be. We just set out with a clear vision that we want to build the most exciting experience we could ever imagine and take audience members on a journey into a completely otherworldly experience that will transform them as well, you know, and help inspire them in ways that they never imagined.
My name is Eamon Armstrong. And this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. I'm your host, Eamon Armstrong. Well, my fellow travelers, thank you for your patience with my brief hiatus. I turned 40. Perhaps I'll do a podcast on growing old and staying young, because I have never felt better. Aside from some aches and pains and not being able to go all night all the time, I still feel very much alive and full of joy and excited for this new decade. More on that another time. For now, we are talking about Boomtown Fair. Today on the show, I'm honored to speak with visionary co-founder and creative director, Lack Mitchell. Now, I first went to Boomtown in 2015, and I was so impressed by the immersive quality and world building of this annual event. So Boomtown Fair is this living, breathing fair with 9 districts and a storyline, hundreds of actors, tons of opportunities to participate and get involved in this strange revolution. 2015 was the revolution storyline at Boomtown Fair. This year, however, Boomtown is resetting with Chapter 1, The Gathering, and we'll talk about that on the show today. So, on the program, we begin with a discussion of English festivals, and many of my listeners may not have been to English festivals, and if you haven't, they are very fun and sometimes very wet. We talk about Glastonbury and the Free Party movement, and then we get into Lack's own personal biography and how he began by building speaker boxes for these events and later became the co-founder of Boomtown. We discuss what it means to create a world and the unique experience of leadership in the context of 17,000 workers all doing their own thing within this broader vision. And that's something that I'm so excited about for this podcast, is this process. And Lack discusses the tools he uses to stay still in this whirlwind creative process and really empower all the creatives around him to do exactly what they want to do. It's quite inspiring. We discuss Boomtown as a political storytelling process and how the events at Boomtown Fair reflected the world around them and, in a certain way, kind of preempted the world around them. We talk about this new focus on eldership, indigenous wisdom, and 6 essential principles, which, as we can see in the show, and as you will see if you attend Boomtown this year, that Boomtown is going through a glorious and gorgeous evolution in support of the kind of world building that can actually build better worlds. Finally, we end with Wake the Tiger, the world's first amazement park that will be opening in Bristol this year. So Lack is the co-founder and creative director of Boomtown Fair, which is an independently owned festival that has grown into one of the largest and most celebrated in the UK. He got his start building speaker boxes for Europe's Free Party movement and later co-founded Boomtown in 2009. He is also the co-founder and creative director of Wake the Tiger, which will be opening this year. And now, tune in to the wisdom and the wonder of Lach Mitchell. I hope you enjoy. How do you pronounce your full name?
Lach Mitchell.
What kind of a name is Lach?
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's not the most elaborate story, only that my little brother couldn't say Luke. My real name's Luke, and my little brother couldn't say Luke when I was younger, so.
That's a great Lach. Story. Your little brother couldn't say Luke, and so he called you Lach, and so now, now you're Lach forever?
Yeah.
Did you legally change your name?
No, not at all. No, it's just stuck.
So you're Luke Mitchell, but you're properly Lach Mitchell because of your little brother. What's his name?
Danny.
And what do you call Danny?
I just call Dan, yeah.
Lach, welcome to Life is a Festival. Welcome to the show.
Cool. Thank you very much.
It's an honor to be speaking with you. And I was so impressed when I came to Boomtown in 2015. And I went to Wilderness and then I had a week off and then I went to Boomtown. And it was those were my first English festivals. I'd never been to English festivals before. And I think a place that we can start, even before we get into the origin of Boomtown and your own experience, is just like what an English festival really is. English festivals to me feel a little different than like a California festival. Mm. There are festivals all over the world, but in England, sometimes they call them fancy dress parties. You know, there's Glastonbury, of course, that we're familiar with from like 1973, the kind of the granddaddy English festival. But Boomtown sits in a long legacy of a certain kind of festival, even going back to like ancient times or like medieval English fetes and that sort of thing, these fairs, which Boomtown is in that tradition. So maybe as a starting place, even before getting to the origin of the festival, we go even a step back and talk a little bit about English festival culture, because I think it's so amazing. And for a lot of my audience, international, US, maybe never been to an English festival, and trust me, totally worth going. Really fun experiences. To you, what is the essence of an English festival?
Yes, good question. I mean, I've grown up inside English festivals. You know, I've been going to Glastonbury since I was in my mum's stomach, really. You know, so going to Glastonbury is like coming home, really. You know, and when you've grown up inside a festival like Glastonbury, which is, you know, renowned around the world, is one of the most famous festivals in the world, isn't it, really? It just feels so normal, really. But I suppose from an outside perspective, it's got this sort of raw sort of, it's really hard. I've never been asked that question, actually, to describe our own sort of festival culture. But a lot of it's inspired from a kind of counterculture of sort of an underground movement, really. The sort of free traveler movement, the free festival movement, all kind of came together. We used to have the big Stonehenge. Do you know Stonehenge?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's close by here, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, the big Stonehenge free festivals. So a lot of it sort of came from that point, really, what is now known as the UK festival scene. It was inspired out of that sort of slightly sort of chaotic, sort of anarchistic sort of scene, I suppose, where it was questioning the norm, really. But I suppose, you know, people like to party all over the world, and I know that, but I mean, English just, they're going hard. It's pretty full on when you get into the deeper parts of Boomtowns and Glastonbury's, you know, it's
You know, I have a perspective on this as a non-English person. I think that there's something to do with the kind of like Victorian English manners, the kind of stiff upper lip vibe when you're talking about this counterculture. When you have a culture that has a dominant kind of a bit of a suppression of emotion, then that emotion has to explode out. It really wants to come out. And I think what's interesting with English festival culture is you have this kind of like buttoned up world in many ways, not entirely, but in many ways kind of a buttoned up world. And then when you get to a festival, when you finally get to a festival, you get that week of the year that's your week. It's at Glastonbury, or maybe you got a couple of them, but you're going to go hard. And it's not just the kind of hard of like, oh, I want to get drunk or I want to like hook up with someone or whatever. It's a kind of hard of like, I want like my glorious animal spirit to come out. I want to wear the most ridiculous flamingo costume so I can get the kind of weird that I couldn't get even close to in my daily life. Would you say that might be part of it?
I'd say that's bang on. Yeah, it really is. Yeah, and I think the English, I think from the outside perspective can be seen as quite well-mannered, you know, and yeah, it's really funny. We used to do these big free festivals around Europe. It's really interesting seeing the difference between the English sound system groups and the French sound system groups and the Italian I definitely felt that we were a lot more polite in the way that we would sort of interact with other sort of people from other countries. And then, like you say, everyone needs to express that part of themselves. It's just like, I don't care, and just get it out. And that does come out in all sorts of wild forms at UK festivals, really.
Well, and Boomtown, I think, sits in a tradition that's interesting, because the counterculture becomes the culture, and then you need a new counterculture, right? So like Glastonbury, kind of in a sense, then became sort of a dominant cultural piece. And tell me if I'm correct in this. Then we have Secret Garden Party kind of took a step away and was kind of counter to sort of like more of a mainstream Glastonbury. And then Secret Garden Party kind of became a little bit more of the common sort of like the thing everyone was aware of. And then Boomtown Fair, I feel like, kind of took the mantle of being more counter. That was my kind of perspective on how that flowed. And maybe there's other factors as well, but, yeah. But kind of this need to constantly have a renewal of counterculture energy.
That's really true. Yeah. I hadn't seen it in that way, but Glastonbury inspired the next generation of festivals that then came up. Those festivals grew up and take on their own identities. We came up out of, I think, a fusion of Glastonbury and the underground sort of free party movement as well, really.
And that was like in the 80s in England. Was there the free party movement, or it's 80s,
well,
90s?
No, it was all the way through, really big in the 90s and then the early 2000s. And that's where we were really kind of part of it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've heard about the free parties. I've not been to any of them, but that's where a lot of like the house music stuff in England was coming out, right? Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think, yeah, huge warehouse parties across London, thousands and thousands of people in 5-6 floors of office, disused office blocks, and they were just massive, you know, and there were some really big groups, a group called Spiral Tribe, actually. Have you heard of Spiral Tribe? Really big collective that, you know, were doing huge free festivals all across the UK and then moved into Europe. And a lot of that inspired the next generation of festivals in where Glastonbury went and where we went. And yeah, it's that movement of people really that want to look at things in a slightly different way.
So kind of getting a sense of the cultural landscape of Boomtown, but I want to get a little bit more into your experience and your experience as a creative. In part, what's great about having a podcast like this is that our audience are all sorts of different people who love festivals, who love transformative culture, who love psychedelics. And a lot of people are creatives, and they want to know how to take the intricacies of their mind and bring them into the world. And one of the things that I think is so inspiring about you as the creative director of Boomtown and as a prime visionary of this community is that you've managed to take some magical things inside your mind and make them physically real in the world and bring community together around them. I want to know how you got from standing in a field drinking cider to getting to a place where not only do you have one of the most innovative gatherings in the world and building a 365-day amazement park, that comes from your mind and then it comes into the world. And I think for our audience, it's really interesting to understand how that happens. So when you were young, were you creating worlds in your mind? Were you envisioning? Were you reading fantasy books that made you want to make an imaginary town or a place that you could go? Or what are the seeds of your vision that ended up being Boomtown Fair?
Yeah, good question. You know, when I think back to when I was really young, I was a really dreamy kid.
You know? No doubt that was the case. Where'd you grow up, by the way?
Just outside Bristol, actually, a place called Bath. And yeah, and I was definitely, I loved Lord of the Rings. You know, I knew it.
Dude, I grew up on that too. And I knew that Lord of the Rings had to be part of this story in some way. I knew it.
Yeah. I loved all of the sort of the fantastical kind of otherworldly stories that are out there. But in school, I didn't do well in school at all. You know, I grew up in secondary school feeling, quite honestly, felt that I was really quite stupid. I was quite unintelligent. The schooling system at that point, you know, and I do feel it's got better now, but at that point it had no support for people that weren't academic or that weren't into, you know, maths and science. You know, I at the time, I now know that I had dyslexia quite heavily in, but I didn't actually, at school, there was no knowledge about that at all. So I just thought, I can't even spell stuff. But I was really into art and really into music. And so school was really tough. But then I quickly realized that I pulled together a gig, like a battle of the bands in my high school. And that was it. I'd been, my mum had been taking me to festivals a lot when I was younger as well. So I felt I was inside a few of the real sort of off-grid Green Gathering type festivals, which were amazing because they were almost like a kind of family and everyone sort of knew everyone. So I spent quite a bit of time in those, but in school, so I put together this Battle of the Bands actually. And I was in bands as well. I played a lot of music. I was in punk bands So we put on this Battle of Bands in the school hall and it was amazing. I mean, it just, everyone turned up and it was wicked. And I was like, oh my God, this is what, God, I really like this. I didn't think that this was something I was ever going to do, to be honest. But I went and did a carpentry course because I thought, well, I love building, you know, I love carpentry. Actually, I can be creative. And actually, if everything goes tits up, then I'll just go be a carpenter. So I did the carpentry apprenticeship, dropped out of school earlier than I probably should have done, but did this carpentry apprenticeship and then started building speakers boxes because I was like, oh, wow, I can maybe tie the two together here. So I started building speaker boxes and then I realized I could keep building these speaker boxes. So I built more and more of these boxes and then I would put these piles of speakers into wherever I could and random fields and things like that. And then people wanted to start hiring them out. So I ended up making a bit of a business out of hiring out these speakers. Before I knew it, I had like a whole lorry full of speakers and then just kept building them. You know, my mates were building them. And before we knew it, we had sort of six or seven lorries full up of speakers and our parties were growing and we were just doing them everywhere, all across the country. And then we quickly discovered that there's this whole movement in Europe. And so we started taking our sound system over into Europe and building stages.
What year was this and what genre of music were you into at this time? What were you playing?
So this was really early 2000s, just around 2000. And we were techno, acid techno, that sort of style, drum and bass. But we would do it with the English sort of way, really. So it'd be reggae and just silly music.
Yeah, yeah.
And then in the mornings, we'd play disco and we would go on for 5-6 days straight. And it just kept going. And the parties were getting bigger and bigger. We ended up in huge free festivals in Dutch Czech Republic. There was 50, 60,000 people there.
And the free festivals were like, you got like a phone number that you would call and you'd call the number to find out where it was and people would just show up. And the free festival movement is a really interesting thing. And I haven't gotten super deep on it. We didn't really have, we had raves. We had like underground raves in the US, but we didn't have anything like what you guys do.
Yeah, it was massive in Europe. And sadly, it's still bubbling away there, but it has been clamped down because the festivals were getting so big. The ones in Czech Republic, for instance, were taking over Czech Republic, really. You know, when you had probably 60, 70,000 people coming in from all over Europe, huge sound systems and just setting up. And of course, with no rules and no sort of infrastructure, they were quite dangerous, really. Well, I wouldn't say they were that dangerous, actually. I mean, in the scale of things, they were pretty together, but there were issues and there was problems there that struggled to be controlled, really. And they kept on growing, you know, and then, of course, the wrong people started getting involved and people coming, because the way that we would all make money is we would turn out of our sound systems and set up bars, and the bars would pay for the fuel for the generators and we would sell merchandise. But then, of course, other groups would come in and just set up big bars and much more organized and take all the money. So because it didn't really have much structure, it would start falling a bit. So anyway, we were doing that for quite a few years, probably like 4 or 5 years. And every time we would come back, we're like, right, we need to build this bigger. It's a huge removal lorry I had as well that I would literally open at the side. It was an 18-ton removals lorry. You know, I was about 20 or 21 when I was driving this thing. And we would just pull up, open the sides of this removals truck and the DJ booth would be there. And then we would have a sound system that would just stretch God knows how long. It was just a huge wall of speakers and we'd be playing with thousands of people there for sort of 6-7 days. And
that sounds glorious. I'm understanding Boomtown Fair so much more now. Just even in this, I didn't understand the free party influence, but like that kind of anarchy, But that kind of like just pull up and make it happen and build a wall of speakers. I can feel how that vibe is in like the madness of Boomtown. However, Boomtown isn't really mad in its structure. It's actually really, really well structured. It's very, very well designed. And so you're talking about these free parties that were lacking structure. So there must have been a moment where you were like, there's a different way to do this, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So we came back to the UK after touring around Europe, doing these big free festivals, and we're like, let's try and do something in the UK in the same way. And of course, we haven't got the space here. It just didn't work at all. And I'm not going to go into the detail of what happened there, but we got into a lot of trouble.
That sounds like a fun story.
But the clear answer was, we need to do this legally. We need to get a license and let's figure this out in the proper way. So we applied to get a license and Boomtown was born really in that way. But the very first years of Boomtown were so chaotic. It was a legal, illegal rave, really. That's what it was. And we had no knowledge about the sort of structure and operational side of what a festival, you know, a legal festival needs to have. And so the first year we did it, we applied for 500 people to come on the license and 1,500 people turned up. And we're like, oh, shit, okay, cool. This is exciting. But I mean, you know, we need to sort ourselves because we didn't have the infrastructure to deal with all of that. And in the local council said, you are never doing this again. So we were like, okay, cool. Yeah, that's fair enough. So we moved somewhere else, moved sites, found a different council, organized ourselves into a better shape, put the event on, and we planned it for 1,500 people. And I think 2,500 people turned up at that point. And again, he had, you know, problems with the infrastructure. And again, the council said, you're not doing this again. So,
luckily, there are different councils and you can kind of keep the show moving around.
Yeah. I mean, they did speak to each other, but we were, I think there was something that the council liked about us that was, it was just quite exciting, really. You know, we were coming with all this decoration and this energy that was just quite fun. And remarkably, that it was at a time where I believe that because the illegal party movement in the UK was such a big problem, councils started relaxing the license applications so that groups could do it in a more legal way. So it was a bit more lenient than perhaps it was before that period. So we then, on the third year, we then discovered this site, Matalea Estate, and we really, you know, we thought we need to really step this up and really get this right. And we planned it all out and we brought in experts in health and safety and licensing and in operations, and we put a proper structure in place, completely made up as we were going along because we didn't really know what we were doing. But we managed to put on, you know, a really safe and really good event at that point. A million problems with it, as you can imagine, but it did go to plan. And that third year was about 12,000 people.
How much of the kind of like immersive theatrical elements were present by year three? Was that something that kind of came a little bit more later, or was that in the inception of the festival? There was that vision.
Yeah, I mean, it was right at the beginning. The idea in the UK festival market was quite saturated, really, and we had no money. If we had lost even a few hundred pounds in the first year, we'd have been bankrupt. So we had to find something that was different. And so there was me and quite a few of our friends, we had our sort of experience in carpentry and set building, and there was groups within us that were circus performers, theatre performers. And when we decided that we were going to create a festival, we wanted to create something more than traditional tents and toilets, you know, and stages. We wanted to build an actual town, a living, breathing town that would have its own story line to it and ever evolve. And so we came up with this idea of Boomtown Fair. And the idea of Boomtown Fair is that it was a real breathing town that once a year had this annual fair in this big celebration. So yeah, so we landed on Boomtown Fair, and by year two, we were building theatrical film set into the experience. And I think that was what the audience, because there was no kind of big name artists or anything like that, there was no promotion or anything like that. It was just like, what are these guys up to? It's just chaos, but in a really fresh and raw and exciting way, really, this raw, unbounded expression of art that no one else had really possibly tapped in onto in that way.
And how did the districts develop? When I was there in 2015, there were 9 districts, and they're all very distinct. I imagine you didn't start, when you had 12,000 people, you didn't start with 9 districts. How did they evolve?
So as the city, well, we started calling it a city. It started off as a town and then it quickly became a city, really. As the city grew, the different themes of the sets quickly started having their own identities. And within, I think, maybe year 4 or 5, we decided that the district, splitting the city into different districts, was a really exciting concept. And it was, funny enough, it was actually inspired by a trip to Disneyland. And so my mum had taken me to Disneyland when I was really young, and I was really fascinated by it, just by the different worlds and the way that it was all laid out. And so I will openly admit that I was massively inspired by Disneyland, you know, in terms of the way that a world could be created, really.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about how a world can be created. Because now we have kind of the lay of the land of Boomtown. We get how Boomtown had kind of come together, that there was a scene, that there was a community, that it came out of this convergence of English festival culture and the Free Party movement. But I'm really fascinated by what it takes to visualize an immersive environment that translates into an experience for a festival goer that feels cohesive, where they're like, they move from one moment to another in kind of a storyline. That experience design really takes a lot of thinking. And I'm curious, you know, you were talking earlier in the podcast how you were dyslexic growing up and you didn't know that that was what was going on. But it sounds like you weren't the kind of genius that school was designed for, but you were a different kind of genius and that Boomtown Fair needed. So I'm wanting to figure out how it got from your brain onto the field.
Yeah, lots and lots of wild ambition, really. You know, I think every year, by the time we do the show, there's always this vision about how the hell can we make this better. But we have something around 17,000 crew, crew and artists that work on the festival in some way, in some shape or another. And I mean, there's a group at the top that kind of shape and set the ideas, and then the ideas just spawn out from that by the thousands of people that then make it their small space down to a window and install in a piece of street set that tells its own story. And I suppose you stand back and think, wow, I mean, how the hell did that kind of manifest into what it is? But it's a process of evolution, really. And we didn't set out with this kind of clear vision of like, this is what we're going to be. We just set out with a clear vision that we want to build the most exciting experience we could ever imagine and take audience members on a journey into a completely otherworldly experience. That will transform them as well, you know, and help inspire them in ways that they never imagined.
Well, and we're going to get into the transformational piece in a little bit here, because I'm really excited about what that looks like for the new chapter one coming up. But let's rest a little bit more on what it means, because what I'm hearing from you is that it's not about your vision per se. It's about empowering all of these different kind of artistic visions to emerge in different places. I'd heard that different stages book their own artists. It sounds like that there's a kind of like collective organizing principle of a kind of like artistic chaos that's happening, and that that's really what is making it so rich and detailed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's in the sort of top sort of, I suppose, creative sort of leadership team, there's a group of us, and we will, 16 months before the show, we will come up with what the storyline's going to look like and what the overarching narrative is. And then out the back of that narrative, it identifies what the main stage scenes look like and the main street scenes in the districts. And then the district identities in the groups that run the districts, they then have their kind of steer. They create their kind of narrative and their storyline off the back of that. That then comes out into the venues and the micros and the, when we say micros, the sort of street venues, which are a small kind of intimate parties from anything from sort of a couple of thousand down to about 50 people sometimes, tiny little kind of secret rooms for people to explore and find. And then from that, even down into the walkabout characters, the street performance, the sideshows, the window installations, the props, right down to the smallest detail in the way that you might see some texture on the side of a doorframe. It all comes down. And I suppose the storyline was always set initially to just give us that steer for everyone to sort of be able to sort of have direction from. And I guess from, you know, where my job really is to, I mean, I talk about it, it's almost like sitting in the middle of a whirlwind. If I can stay in that stillness, right in the middle of that whirlwind, if I touch the edge of that whirlwind, I get swept up and then I lose everything basically. So I have to sit just bang on in the middle of it and keep the plate spinning all the way around. And that's where the, you know, the magic just comes, you know. And I always have these amazing ideas and sort of sow these seeds of the different creative kind of managers. And every single time it comes back way better than I ever even imagined, really. So, because they've got ownership.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful creative process then. I love the visual of that, of like sitting in this whirlwind. And that must take a certain degree of self-discipline and a certain degree of self-care. I understand that you're a meditator. I am as well. I find it to be an extraordinarily valuable tool. I think for the creators who are listening to this podcast now, who may be earlier in their career, can you give us some suggestions for how to really come to that center of stillness, to be able to be creative with all of this going around, to be able to offer these ideas and give them freely to others so that they can iterate and return them? How does one really stay in that point of center? What tools do you use?
Yeah, wow. It's a good question. Something that I still don't feel I've fully cracked, to be honest. I do get up at 5 a.m. most mornings, and I sit in that place of just waking. And that's where every single one of my kind of the visions and the ideas and the creativity has always come from. And I quickly get that written down, and then I focus and come back into waking up at that point. And I do really enjoy meditation, just in its simplest form of sitting kind of in nature. Not even necessarily like deeply meditating, but just being present with the way that the leaves are moving on the trees, you know, in the way that the wind is blowing, and just listening to the birds. And but they, you know, I do really enjoy a meditation called transcendental meditation, which is done for a mantra. And that's quite good, because that does allow me to drop into a deeper place. And I do, in that deeper place, I can map out huge scale visions that are really, I can wander around. The festival is enormous, but I can tell you every single light fixture in that festival. And I walk around that festival and get the feeling of, right, what am I going to generally feel from this particular position in the festival? What am I going to see? What am I going to hear? And that really helps. But there is a fine line of balance between working and looking after, you know, yourself. Because if I don't get a good enough sleep, I know that I'm not going to work that day. I'm just not going to be able to be productive. And I'll say to my team, heads up, there's no point even having a conversation with me today, because I didn't have quite enough sleep. And I used to beat myself up a bit about it. I'll come into a meeting and end up saying the wrong things and then beat myself up. And then it took me a while to realize I just need to get the right amount of sleep. And then it's okay. If I just name it, then it's okay.
Sleep is so important. Sleep is something I'm working on in my life right now. I have this like sleep tracking ring, and I have trouble with my memory, and I've just become aware that I'm just not sleeping. And it's funny how again and again, I'll have conversations about what are your tools? What are your hacks? What are your things? And it's like nature, meditation, sleep. The self-care piece is so important for all of these creative ventures, because we can't push ourselves into this overdrive and then think that when we're interacting with a whole team of artists, we're not going to accidentally like blow up on somebody because we haven't taken care of ourselves. You were talking about being in the middle of the storm and not touching it and getting swept away. If you're in the middle of the storm and you become a storm yourself because you haven't taken care of yourself, the whole thing falls apart.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's probably a team of 60 that work full-time in the office. And It is stressful. The running a festival when your whole business model is based around one weekend, it's stressful. I struggle to see a business model which is quite as ridiculous as that. Basically, if it rains, and you know, we're talking about being in England in summer, if it rains, your business model like falls to pieces. It's so stressful, you know, and holding that together, especially when, you know, we've now been hit with things like COVID, which has wiped out the industry, and it's just forever problems. I mean, we got hit by a hurricane in 2019. So
during the festival?
Yeah.
You got hit by a hurricane during the festival in 2019, right before COVID?
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah, yeah. We got, year before that, we got hit with extreme rain where we have rivers running through the site with the winds. You know, I thought rain was bad, but wind is another level completely, because we had stages that are 90 foot in the air with 20, 30,000 people dancing in front of them. And it's just the fear around, you know, what happens if one of these things, if something, just the fear around it is just, it's so stressful. And you're dealing with the energy of tens of thousands of people as well. And they're essentially, you're looking after their welfare, and they're in quite a condensed condition as well. So yeah, so I can't remember what the question was.
We were talking about staying calm and centered in the midst of all of that. So sometimes I think it's about just pausing, even in this moment when you're thinking about the magnitude of it, of being like, okay, come back to the why, and then sort out the how with the help of everyone.
Absolutely, yeah. But for all of the stress, there is nothing more incredible than opening those gates and seeing tens of thousands of people running through those gates. And they run as well. They run into their fields and set their campsites up and meet their neighbors and meet lifelong friends. And we have, afterwards, you know, hundreds of these comments come through just saying, that just changed my life. That's what we really, that just makes everything just so worthwhile, really.
Well, and let's get into a little bit about impact. And first I want to talk about Boomtown is a political storytelling process, or the political storytelling process of Boomtown. So the year that I went was 2015, and the storyline was about revolution at that time. And there was an Orwellian quality to it. And I do want to note that there were sex robots. I remember that as something that really stuck out to me, is that there were sex robots. So lots of interesting things. But there was a revolution happening, and there was this Banghai Palace, and it really felt, I got to say, like, I love immersive experiences. I'm a big burner. I love experiences where you feel like something is really happening. And when that palace like lit up, like the culminating piece of that festival, when the anonymous revolutionaries came out on the loudspeaker, it felt like the Banghai Palace just went nuts. Like everybody just went nuts about it. And you really felt like swept up in the experience of revolution. Like you really felt it. And that's part of why I've always been in awe of the experience design that you're involved in, is it felt real. It felt real when I was there. And it had this political message. So I'd like to just talk a little bit about that aspect of it, the way in which it's political, the way in which it sort of mirrors culture, and how you can really create so much catharsis in the tens of thousands of people there.
Yeah, I mean, the year of the revolution was massive. Doug, who is our kind of head of narrative, the elder festival member, I suppose, he's a real old anarchist sort of punk and squatted for most of his life, really. And so he writes the story, and he was actually the masked man as well, which is really cool. So he came out, and when he held his fist up and said, "This is the revolution," and 15,000 people put their fists in the air as well.
I did too. I was there. I put my fist in the air. And then just the stage just explodes and the whole thing.
Yeah.
That was a great moment.
Yeah. We were really like, okay, wow. We have got a responsibility here to do the right thing. Because what we say, there's a huge amount of people that are looking up to us or looking to us in what we say about things. We've got to be quite careful here and the way that we kind of come across in our narrative and our storyline. And some of us were like, let's push it. Let's just see how far we can push this, you know? And then of course we have to be quite careful because we don't want to alienate people. So We were quite careful to sort of stay quite neutral in terms of when the elections came up. A lot of people were like, well, you know, what's Boomtown going to say? And we were quite quiet about it, really, even though we have very strong views about it. But we ended up branching out into, we started going into sort of artificial intelligence and stuff like that into the storyline, and started exploring what was sort of going on behind the scenes with data and stuff like that. And we built this big tower block that was sort of based around Trump Towers, which was this big sort of brutalist kind of stage set with this big sort of corporate CEO who was just in control of absolutely everything. You know, in the end, we decided that we would uncover the masked man and that everyone would see the masked man's face. And then it was actually the CEO of Banghai Palace, which was, and it was his whole big twist that actually, who do you trust? Anyway, it was going deeper and deeper, you know, and we were mind-boggling ourselves. We were having a lot of fun. But then what was really interesting is that in 2019, we decided that we really wanted to highlight the climate emergency. A lot of our group were doing Extinction Rebellion, which I don't know if you've heard of, but the movement was really kicking off at that point. And it was this big drive, still hopefully is this big drive, but to really expose the climate crisis there. And so we thought, right, we'll put all our focus into that, really. And we decided to call a state of emergency. We created this story that this virus had come out of one of the districts called Area 404 and infected everyone. And the city had gone into this kind of state of emergency.
This is 2019 you did this, right?
2 months later. I mean, we had posters all across London with state of emergency, virus infection. And then literally 2-3 months later, COVID kicked off in wherever it was. And we called this, and there's a real state of emergency. It was absolutely, we were just blown away by it. What was going on there? We were mirroring the real world, but we were ahead of the real world. And yeah, it was completely mind-blowing, really.
So you were mirroring the real world, but you were ahead of the real world. And now, 2 years later, festivals are coming back. Boomtown Fair is coming back after a 2-year hiatus. And you've decided to reboot, in a sense. You went 12 chapters. You went through a full arc, a full experience. There's been a break, and now you're coming back to chapter one. And chapter one is called The Gathering. And I'm super inspired by this, by the way. I feel like there's a leveling up that I see happening here in terms of the responsibility that you have to a world that needs leadership. Mac McCartney came by the Boomtown office recently. I know that he's a mentor of yours. And I know that you're looking for the mentorship of elders. There's an interesting thing. You're about to turn 40. I'm about to turn 40. We're leveling up in our lives. We're stepping into more and more leadership. These incredible stories that have been told through Boomtown Fair have mirrored society in certain ways, but you were a bit of ahead of society. Now, in a sense, I feel like you have the opportunity to not just mirror society, but to say, what world do we want? And you're calling in eldership and wisdom. So I'd like to hear about the kind of inspiration that you've gotten, that the community here has gotten, and how that is going to translate into an entirely new Boomtown Fair.
Yeah, wicked. Yeah, so festivals grow with their organizers. And we, after sort of 4 or 5 years in, we as organizers had kind of grown in ourselves, and we'd have families, kids who came up. We'd moved away from the kind of the rave scene, I suppose. We were into different styles of music. We were building kids' areas at the festival. And the festival was growing and growing with all so much energy from all these amazing people. And it was becoming all these, you know, incredible things. But it was missing a really kind of vital part, really. It was damaging the earth. There was huge amounts of litter left over at the end of the festival. People were leaving the festival really broken, completely broken inside themselves. And
because of just pushing it too hard with partying and not taking care of their bodies.
Absolutely. You know, and we were encouraging that because that's what the festival was all about. It was just, let's just put on the most insane party experience we possibly can. And very quickly, I think we were like, there's got to be more reason why we're doing this. It can't just be for everyone to come and absolutely, you know, smashed and left ruined and crawling back to their kind of lives. There's got to be a lot more to it, really. So for me, on a personal one, I decided to sort of get my backpack together and I went on a mission down to Peru, found a family of shamans in Peru, found them online, and I wanted to go and learn from them and understand more what it was I was there to do, really, as being a leadership position of this incredible platform. So it was quite incredible, really. I pretty much said almost goodbye to my wife and kids. I was like, I don't know where I'm going. I'm going to go into the jungle and this is going to be really interesting. So I did it and I went down there and it was quite scary because I didn't know where I was going. But when I found this family of shamans and indigenous people from a tribe called the Shipibo tribe, and just the welcoming and the warmth, just instantly, as soon as I kind of arrived, just for every kind of possible worry, you know, totally gone. I was staying with them. I was living with them.
How long were you there?
I was only there for a few weeks, but it was enough to really understand, you know, how they lived and what was important to them.
And did you drink medicine with the Shipibo?
Yeah. So I worked with them and drunk plant medicine called ayahuasca, which is a sacred, ancient sacred medicine that's been with them for, I have no idea, probably thousands of years maybe. But more than that, through their teachings, when they would hold their ceremonies, just understanding the connection they had to the land and to themselves, which completely changed my life in ways I can't even really describe, because I didn't really realize how disconnected from earth, from nature I was until I went into the jungle and learned from those people. And they had nothing. They had absolutely nothing down there, but they didn't need anything. They were content in where they were, you know, and it was just so humbling to see, really. So I then brought that back to the festival team. And the first thing I said to everyone was that everything needs to be a lot more colourful. So literally, I mean, if anyone came the year after that, they would have probably noticed that all the stages were a lot more colourful than they were the year before. But more than that, I really understood that we can use our way of storytelling, our way of creativity to inspire shifts in mindset and inspire change in a positive way. And that was a really unique place. So since that point, I really, and the team really embarked on our own self-development journeys with a real clear understanding of an idea of the twin trail. I don't know if you've heard of the twin trail.
No, I haven't. What is that?
The twin trail is, and it was taught to me by my teacher, my mentor, Matt McCartney, and he was taught by a group of Native Americans. The twin trail is the path of the inner work and the path of the outer work, both in tandem with each other. If you both need to happen in balance, if you focus on one without the other, then you'll crash and burn. You know, if you're just on the inner work, then the outer doesn't happen. If you're just on the outer, then you'll crash and burn without doing the inner. So that kind of set us on this journey of constant sort of healing and growth inside, allowed us to do the outer work of growth with the festival, and understanding that growth isn't about just growing in scale. It's about growing in, you know, maturity and in growing in so many different ways, isn't it?
One of the things that has evolved with Boomtown is the ethos of Boomtown. And I know that coming into this new chapter one, you have six principles. I love principles for temporary communities. I think they're so valuable. Burning Man does a killer job with this. The Burning Man 10 principles, people really embody them, but other festivals have them too. And it's interesting, you were just talking about how when you went to the jungle, you realized that what you wanted most was a deeper connection to self, deeper connection to each other, deeper connection to the earth. And that's the first three of the principles, is respect yourself, respect each other, respect the planet. And then the other three being creativity, connection, and celebration, which you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation. And so I think that this idea of being guided by principles and then bringing those principles into your own life and embodying them and then bringing them into the festival. That's actually similar to me to what you were talking about creative artistic leadership, where it's not about necessarily having rules that need to be followed so that someone behaves a certain way. Instead, it's about having principles that are embodied and inspire people to choose their behavior in alignment with principles rather than constrict their behavior to conform to rules. I think it's a really important distinction. And for Boomtown, it's so much about freedom and self-expression. So how does one use a principle to funnel self-expression into growth and healing and connection versus have a rule to be like, don't express yourself in this way that's bad. Don't do this. It's more like, do this. And I think that that's something that'll be interesting. And coming into this year with Boomtown is having these principles be even more deeply imbued in the festival.
Yeah, it was interesting. For years, we were trying to establish what our values were. And it took us to go down into a place called Devon in the south of England with no reception. And it was just, it felt so ridiculously simple that it was just respect yourself, each other, and the planet. But it just, then it was just so clear, you know, and that enabled us to deeply, once we really understood that's what those core values were, to deeply embed them into the fabric of absolutely everything. So that whenever we make a decision, whenever any new idea or plan would come onto the table, we would look at those values and see, does it align with those values? And it's been an amazing thing, actually. I really strongly recommend. It's hard when you're first starting a kind of event or an experience or a festival, and it's just, you're just trying to kind of get it off the ground and trying to make it sort of financially work, really. But if you can establish that right at the very beginning, it really does help you understand who you are and the audience understand who you are as well.
Can you give us any kind of sneak preview of what the storyline might be like for chapter one? I know that there's probably a procedure in which these things are released and what people talk about, but I know that there will be a lot of Boomtown Fair fans here. Did you know there's a Facebook group just for the Boomtown storyline? There's like 8,000 people in a group that are like guessing about storylines. I was looking at that in preparation for this. So there's a lot of interest and people are like, what's the story? What's it going to be? You're going to chapter one. You're starting again. And we're talking about these values. We're talking about the influence of eldership, the influence of medicine, the influence of making things more colorful. Can you give us a little sneak preview of some of what the story is going to feel like?
Yeah, well, I'll just quickly touch on where Boomtown is at the moment, because we grew so quickly and it was easier for us to grow in scale than it was to try and organize it or sort of tame it, I suppose. So it grew into all these amazing things. And of course, we were having people from everywhere saying, I want to do this. And it was easier for us to just say, all right, cool, let's do it. Let's sell some more tickets and pay for it, than try and argue with them that they can't do it. But it quickly grew into all these different things. And actually, it was so complicated by the end of year 19. And this was another thing as well. We'd never set out to do headline artists, really, big artists, big name artists. It was never our thing. But we had a couple of artists. There's a band called Grillers, actually, which I'm sure everyone's familiar with, that approached us.
Yeah, they're perfect for Boomtown. That's such a great synergy, Grillers and Boomtown.
Absolutely, yeah. So we had bands like Grillers who wanted to play at the festival, who sort of approached us and were up for just playing for the crack of it, really, not really charging us much money. Of course, we're not going to say no, but we knew that we do things like that, then people are going to be expecting, you know, who's going to be the next Grillers? Who's going to be... But of course we did it. And then naturally the next year, everyone was like, wow, they did that last year. What's going to be the next one? And of course, that wasn't the intention. So quickly, there was a huge proportion of the audience who were looking at what was the top three artists on a poster rather than what the ethos and essence of Boomtown was. So when COVID came in, actually, it was really hard letting go of the festival and a lot of the team and cancelling something we'd spent, you know, so long building up. But actually, it was a bit of a blessing in disguise, because it allowed us to pause for a moment, reflect, and really look at who we were and what we wanted to be. And we decided that the best thing to do there was to reset the festival, to come back to chapter one and come right back to the beginning. We held hundreds of focus groups with all of the top sort of fans and audience members of Boomtown. So, you know, what is it that you really care about in terms of what you want Boomtown to be? And we spoke to hundreds of crew members, and everyone was the same. It was the core essence of the sort of creativity of Boomtown that everyone wanted to remain, and people weren't interested in the big lineups and the artists. So we decided to tell the audience or launch that we're now no longer even releasing artists ahead of the festival. We wanted people to come purely on the values of the festival and the ethos. And so we did that, and we relaunched it, and we decided that the best thing to do, what was the fundamental kind of ethos of Boomtown, it was a gathering, really, of people to come together to celebrate, to learn and to grow, and to take that learning to the outside world and pass it on to other people. So when we decided that chapter one, the title, was going to be The Gathering, it was The Gathering in the most simplest form of just coming together and celebrate this view that we can actually connect back together properly, you know, something that has seemed almost impossible over the last couple of years, truly connect in that way. There's micro stories in every district. There's no overarching story other than this is celebration of the fact we can all come back together. And the story will evolve massively in chapter two. And where that goes, we have no idea.
So it's kind of like clearing the plate, letting everyone come together, and then seeing what percolates. And could it be the case that with an audience that's so involved and so participatory, that someone who's attending Boomtown and is engaged in the experience could trigger something that might end up being like a mature storyline down the road? Like just an attendee comes and participates and gets involved in a district storyline in a certain way, and an attendee could actually influence the story that blossoms from that down the road?
Absolutely. There's so many ideas floating around, as you can imagine. We've had sort of 3 years of dreaming, you know. But I think the biggest thing for us at the moment is we need the festival to be more sustainable in terms of what the footprint it leaves. And we are not there. We want to be a Leave No Trace festival. That's absolutely critical. And we're at the point where we'd rather not do the festival than create the environmental problems we are creating. So all our focus and energy at the moment is based around how can we minimize our impact on the land as the kind of primary focus, really. And we're looking at sort of education within the audience through sort of micro storylines in the districts and right down to the smaller venues. The way that we've actually redesigned the site based on it making it easier for audience members to respect the land. You know, just simple things, the way that the camping experience, if it's a nicer camping experience, people are less, not necessarily need to bring so many things to the festival that they might end up leaving. And the way that we encourage people to take their litter back, we're doing this 11 in the morning, we're doing this big site-wide sort of clear up, everyone together before any music turns on, the whole site, everyone clears up for 10 minutes, clear up your space, and then we start. The team are so passionate about this, you know, and again, it's been great having teachings from people like Matt McCartney, who comes in, he's a kind of the mentor for the festival, really, to come in and again, help just remind us of the importance of respecting the land. We do huge opening and closing ceremonies on the main stages, and I don't want to give away much, but the way that we will open it more with elders and close it more with the next generation. So it's almost kind of like passing the baton down and treating the festival almost like the festival is a ceremony in many ways.
I love that.
You open it, then you go through this big, deep, kind of powerful process. And then Sunday's always our more celebration day. And then we close it out with big ceremony and then go home. And that's been inspired by the ceremonies from the Indigenous people hold.
Yeah, and so that brings us back to the through line of our conversation, which is about world building. And there's building a world that's entertaining. There's building a world that you can party in. There's also building the world that you know is possible. Building a vision of the world that is going to be something where people go home and they're like, I want to make my life more like this. And when you say the festival is a ceremony, it's so beautiful, you know, because what are you giving these kids? They're, and not all kids, but like kids are coming to this festival. 18-year-old kids coming to this festival. And they get an experience that they get a window into a transformational ceremonial experience that is also still a festival and a party. That's a really special thing to be offering. And to leave it in such a way where there's an invitation to bring that spirit home, to go back to your daily life and to treat people with that open-hearted joy that you can have in the festival, to go through and have a transformative experience and have a different relationship to the land. You know, many people coming from London or from wherever, they're not necessarily as in touch with the land, but at the festival they are. And then they go back and they have a different vision. So this idea, it's of course the show is life is a festival. But what I hear you saying about Boomtown is like, the festival is a ceremony. The ceremony can be transformational.
Absolutely. It's so powerful. You know, in 2019 show, I guess, we had probably 45,000 people were at the opening ceremony. We asked every single person in that ceremony to put their hand on the next person's shoulder and one hand on their heart. And then we did this kind of opening speech, really. And just the, you know, there's people that, you know, you could tell were a bit uncomfortable that what's going on, but they all did it. And some of the feedback we had from people, like, we didn't know what was going on, but there was an energy that we couldn't quite understand. All of a sudden, this feel of connection. I think something that I've really understood more is that, you know, us as from Boomtown, we will mirror the way that I've been taught to hold ceremonies. The Indigenous people, you know, they, when they hold their ceremonies, from what I've seen, they like to party. They get all dressed up, you know, and they go for it. They'll stay up for days at these parties, but they do it with etiquette, this form of etiquette that just swims through absolutely everything. And if we can bring that into the festival scene, into festival experiences, where we're going to have this amazing party, we're going to celebrate, we're going to party for days, but we're going to do it with respect for ourselves, for each other and the planet, that underpins it all, then, you know, that's just a beautiful thing, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. I was speaking about bringing the festival to your daily life. And there's a whole nother initiative from the Boomtown community to bring a festival experience into daily life. And that is this amazement park, which you very generously just walked me through. You're halfway through production and you just walked me through what this is going to be. So we're here at the Boomtown headquarters here in Bristol. My first time in Bristol. Lovely town. Full of art. Full of a very colorful place. And you're going to be opening, before Boomtown, before the festival even happens, you're going to be opening an amazement park here at Boomtown HQ. And so as we're coming to the end of our conversation today, I'd love for you to just share a little bit about that, and just as an invitation to those who are fans of Boomtown Fair or those who just happen to be traveling through Bristol. You're opening in 3 months. Tell us a bit about the amazement park.
Yeah, wow. So it's called Wake the Tiger. And that was inspired by a book around trauma.
Is that Peter Levine's book?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's this idea of waking that inner part of ourselves to bring about change, really. So we, for years, we've had this dream that we wanted to create an all year round version of our creative concept and open up our narrative and storytelling to a much wider demographic, to everyone, really, not just an audience that are open to living in a field and paying 200 quid for ticket or whatever, listen to certain styles of music. We want it to be open to everyone. So we brought this derelict old complex in central Bristol, which we'd spent every penny we'd ever, and more. I always laugh about it because when we bought it, we went to the estate agent to pick the keys up and they said, you haven't got any keys, you haven't got any doors. So anyways, we were stood in this burnt out shell that had been squatted and raved and by all our mates, to be fair, but we could see the vision of it. It's just absolutely just had it was just everything that we wanted in a place because we could just make it completely our own. So in line with kind of our insane sort of passion for creating worlds, we invented this world called Meridia, which was sort of based on the sort of meridian lines, and where you would have the meridian lines cross, they create these, in our world, they create these portals to different dimensions. So we've created this whole story around people will come to this experience and they step through this portal into this other dimension. And it's based around this factory that's aesthetically sits somewhere between sort of Willy Wonka, Mad Max and Harry Potter, if that puts it into perspective. But so very, very detailed from the sort of scenery side of things. And the audience explore this dream factory, really, where all these sort of alchemists and scientists and wizards are all experimenting, creating all these solutions to the world's greatest problems. And some of the solutions are going well, some of them are not going as well, and creating up different portals into different worlds entirely. But each experiment is based around a topic which we feel really strongly about. So, for instance, there's a whole ice realm there, which is based around Wim Hof, his breathing techniques, and we explore astrology, we explore kind of dreaming and waking, we explore meditations, we explore the beauty of nature, helping to us to understand and see the beauty of nature again, but all in a really fun, engaging, creative and playful way as well. And it's all through exploration and discovery. So the audience can kind of skim through and then they can just gaze at the art, or you can dive deeper into the storyline. But ultimately, at the end of the experience, and we've created it and consulted on the whole park, we've consulted with elders and indigenous communities. And what is it? What are we looking for? Is like the answer to the world's problems, really, you know. And it's been really, you know, every answer that it's always come back is this finding this connection back to ourselves, back to nature. So they go through all of this experience, and you know, one of the rooms is all made out of sea plastic, and we're looking at our oceans. And but at the end of the experience, they've come into this big temple. We call it the Temple of Self, and they do at that point find a connection. It shows that we need to get all parts of ourselves into balance to find that kind of wholeness, I suppose, or that sense of connection to ourselves. So it's a ever evolving beast, but it's so fun. You know, there's around 120 or 130 artists working on it at the moment, everything from story writing to scenery, to prop making, to robotics, to creative technology, to design, to all of these different kind of aspects are all coming together to create this amazing experience. And it's going to be open all year round. And yeah, you know, if anyone's ever passed in Bristol, then yeah, come on in, because it's quite an incredible new venture.
Yeah, and Bristol is considered such an incredible artistic hub in this part of the world. You know, Banksy's from here, and there's reasons to come and visit this place. And I love that this will become another reason to come and visit this place. And it's opening soon. Like, it's opening before Boomtown this year. It's projected to be 3 months from now. So if you're listening to this podcast, you can plan a trip to Bristol. You could plan a trip to the UK, hit up Boomtown, and come here, right? You could do both.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Boomtown sold out for this year.
I'm sure we can figure something out. I'm sure we could work something out. I might have an in with some of the organizers. Yeah. Send me an email. We'll see about it.
Absolutely, yeah. We're so proud of Bristol. It's got so many amazing people doing so many amazing things. And to be able to build this in the center of Bristol and really enhance its amazing, rich artistic culture is a really wonderful thing. So, yeah, who knows where this will go, but it's exciting.
Who knows where any of this will go? But what I love is that it's constantly iterating and it's constantly responding to what the world needs. And I love just the story of going to the jungle. I love your conversations with Mac McCartney. And I love how open and receptive you are. And just as a reflection, I came here to try to crack open some of your visionary genius. What I'm hearing in this conversation is that it is so much about community. It's so much about empowering other artists. It's so much about receiving wisdom from elders. It's so much about creating spaces for the next generation. And I think that that's really the takeaway. If we're talking about world building here, it takes a world to build a world, man. Like, that's the thing. Absolutely. It's not that it was in your head and you put it on a field. It's that it evolved from rows of speakers and from the hands of all these people. And I think that's just such a beautiful lesson.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're so right there. You know, I think giving people the opportunity is such an amazing gift that I feel so privileged to be in this place where someone can come to me with an idea and I can give them the support and resources to be able to make that idea become reality. And I've taken so many risks, which on reflection aren't really risks, but you know, at the time they could be seen as risk, where I've said, I've given someone, right, his 12 grand, go and make that idea. And every single time it's come back, they've given it 110% and they've been able to build these amazing art pieces or whatever. And then they've gone on to then being able to, they've learned all these new skills and they've then on building up their own kind of experiences and brands. And we've seen all these new festivals and events spawn off of the back of Boomtown, as we did off the back of our sort of elder festivals like Glastonbury and the gatherings, the old free festival gatherings. Everyone inspiring everyone is the way that everything should go.
That is the way. Lack, how can we follow you? Do you publish things personally? Do you on social media? Obviously, Boomtown Fair, we'll put all the links in the show notes so people can follow Boomtown Fair and the social media there. But do you put anything out there in the world? I know you've been kind of more in the underground area of things. If we wanted to follow your work personally, how might we do that?
You can't really.
All right. Okay. But you can follow Boomtown Fair. You can follow the work through Boomtown.
Yeah, I think Boomtown and now Wait the Tiger as well will be the two platforms that we're going to be pushing and evolving.
Beautiful. Well, dear listeners, you can check out Boomtown. It is sold out this year. You know, what? I feel like there could be some wiggle room. Maybe in that. But now I'm going to get a bunch of Boomtown Fair like fans who are going to reach out to me and be like, I don't know who you are, but you seem like an American dude who might be able to get me a ticket. Boomtown Fair is happening in early August, as it always does. And I hope to be there this year. Lack, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I've been so inspired by Boomtown Fair and you did not disappoint. This has been a wonderful interview. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, it's been really good to connect with you. And I think, you know, speak to someone that's clearly got a really good understanding of sort of the global festival industry and scene. And yeah, it's been really good. Yeah, so thank you very much for coming over.
My pleasure.
Wicked.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you liked the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.